very good morning to you. Welcome into today's programme. Now, the Ayr na Éireann winner for today is Dean O'Connor. So congratulations, Dean. You've got yourself a pair of tickets. You can go from Galway Docks or you can go to Rosseville, and you can go to any of the three islands from there. And the overall upgraded winner is Tony Dunn from Ballinasloe. Tony, you've got yourself that overnight stay indeed. And in the wonderful Inishmore as well. So well done to Dean O'Connor, today's winner. All the names went into a hat. Fiona picked somebody out, and Tony Dunn then is the overall winner from there. Now, can I ask you to do me a few things? There's an African grey parrot with a red tail. Now, it flew away from their apartment in Westside yesterday afternoon, but if anybody knows anything, could you please call reception here on 091-770-077. So again, an African grey parrot, red tail, flew away from the apartment in Westside yesterday. And if anybody knows anything about it, could you be good enough, please, to give us a call from there. Some of the comments that have come into us today. Then I'm going to give you a chance to win, by the way, so stay with us on this one. Keith, this caller, said, what a wonderful story that you just had there. An Irishman, especially from the wonderful county of Limerick, doing so well. If he's not creating jobs and doing so well, his beloved Limerick are winning all Ireland's. Well done to all involved there. A fascinating man, I have to say. Absolutely wonderful. And even as he was leaving, we were still talking about general life stuff. So we were, Michael Dowling, that is the CEO of Northwell Health, the biggest indeed health organisation in New York. Now, I'm going to give you a chance to win. How am I going to do this, though? I have to kind of make this up as I go along, will I?
Let's call out his name, Tommy K, Tommy K. Tommy K, the DJ, Tommy K, Tommy K.
There you go now. And on Thursday, April the 4th, at the Shearwater Hotel, and this is what's going to happen. Mike Denver is going to perform that song and others. But again, we're giving you a chance today to win a pair of tickets indeed to the show on Thursday the 4th of April in the Shearwater Hotel. You can get Mike Denver in concert and he with special guest Philomena Begley, Brendan Shine at the Shearwater Hotel on Thursday next the 4th of April. Tickets are on sale at the hotel reception and on ticketmaster.ie. So if you want to win a pair of tickets, if I do this again, if you hear Tommy K again, on this programme today. Where did I put it? I put it somewhere there, so I did. But if you do see that again or hear that again, what you do is you text us straight away to 086 38 33 55 3.
Let's call out his name, Tommy K, Tommy K. Tommy K, the DJ, Tommy K, Tommy K.
I can't sing it. We better just not do it. Anyway, get texting straight away to 086 38 33 55 3 and be in with a chance to win a pair of tickets to that on Thursday next. Quick commercial break, and we have a lovely documentary coming the way about the Hat Factory. Where? The Hat Factory. Do you know where the Hat Factory is? I do. I'm old enough to remember it. But the Hat Factory was in Bohermore, where the apartments are now, then became the Carra Mineral Waters. But all of that comes next, and I'll tell you more about that. Stay tuned. Now, very good Friday morning to you. Welcome into today's programme. It's Good Friday. We hope that you have a great Easter ahead indeed, and that everyone is as happy as you can be this Easter. Now, though, let's go to a lovely documentary that is just magic. It's all about the Hat Factory indeed, and I'll be back just after this.
When I was young, I used to admire these two girls. They were lovely girls. And I found out they were working in the Hat Factory. And I thought, oh, I'd love to work there, you know. My father had a cousin that was a secretary up in the Hat Factory called Minnie Brown. He spoke to her and I got the job. And it was the happiest time of my life.
It was nice. I enjoyed it anyway. I liked the song, you see. So we're all pleased with this because there was nothing else, and they got a few shillings, you know. So they were glad to have something to do.
Veronica Joyce O'Toole and Margaret Long Casserly recalling their teenage years working in the Hat Factory in 1940s Galway. The factory, which was officially opened in 1938, occupied a 3-acre site at the top of Bohermore, opposite the gates of the cemetery. It was constructed by Stuarts of Lower Salt Hill at a cost of £11,000. There is no trace of the building now, but the memories of the people who worked there live on. We will hear some of these and get a sense of the economic and social impact of the factory. Reflecting on the time when she started work, Margaret was not too far wrong when she remembers very few job opportunities in the town. Historian Dr. John Cunningham.
Galway had been struggling economically since the famine of the 1840s. Work was generally scarce, especially for women. There's a Carnib hosiery, which closes in 1934, and Galway woolen mills, which closes in 1938. There's great anticipation, therefore, at the opening of a new industry.
Its official title was Le Mode Moderne, but that name never caught on with Galwegians. It was always known as the Hat Factory. So why and how did a business with the French name come to the west of Ireland town, where the locals knew nothing about making hats? Historian Dr. Tricia Oakley Kessler explains.
In 1932, Fianna Fáil came into governance, and one of the key economic policies was to advance protectionism. Eamon de Valera had this great vision of developing a self-sufficient agricultural and industrial economy. And to that end, the key policy of that agenda was to look at import substitution, at the huge imports that were coming mostly from Britain into Ireland, and developing Irish manufacturing to produce those imports in Ireland.
It was an ambitious plan and worked to an extent in developing homegrown industries, particularly the manufacture of footwear. Sean Lamass, the Minister for Trade, Industry and Commerce, sought to build on this, and he saw the development of an Irish hat industry to stem the flow of imports as an important step. Getting the plan off the ground, however, was not straightforward.
There was a lack of manufacturing skills and also a lack of capital investment. Even though there was a lot of Irish money overseas, Sean Lamass struggled to get Irish industrialists to finance this idea of self-sufficiency. So it was very clear that this wasn't going to work out well because they didn't really have the machinery or the capital investment or the know-how to actually begin manufacturing of hats on an industrial scale.
The rise of fascism in Europe presented the government with an opportunity to remedy this. The Council for German Jewry wrote to the British and Irish government seeking help for the Jews fleeing Nazi persecution. It was suggested that Jewish industrialists could provide finance and skilled workers. Lamass dispatched trade delegations to investigate the possibilities. Senator John Eddie McKellen from Ball in County Mayo and a Jewish businessman, Marcus Whitsum, played a prominent role in these delegations. Dr. Tricia Oakley Kessler, author of A History of Jewish Involvement in Irish Industry, tells us that these two met Henri Orbach, a German Jew, and his business partner, Marcel Goldberg. They were running a small but successful factory in Paris, and they were asked to consider expanding their business to Ireland. Orbach's niece, Rachel Phillipson Levy, wrote about the reaction to this proposal in her memoir.
The partners think it could be an excellent business proposition, and the junior partner, Serge, my father, is sent on a reconnaissance mission. He returns to Paris full of enthusiasm. The proposal offers endless possibilities, and the prospects in Galway on the Irish west coast are most promising. After many weeks of discussion, it is decided that Serge will be put in charge of the new project on behalf of the Paris Group. It is the opportunity of a lifetime.
The company agreed to invest £40,000. A further £20,000 came from Irish investors. Serge Phillipson, who was married to Orbach's sister Sophie, arrived in Galway in July 1937 and immediately set up the Irish branch of Le Mode Moderne in a temporary premises in Eyre Square with a staff of approximately 20. Most of these were Europeans with experience in hat design and manufacture. Serge's wife and daughter came to Galway for the grand opening on July 18, 1938.
There was a huge celebration when it was opened. There were three flags flying on the factory. There was the papal flag, the Irish flag, and the French flag with Vive la France on it. These three flags basically summed up the industrial vision and promise of Fianna Fáil.
The target was to produce 1 million ladies' hats a year. But was there a market for this? According to the Connacht Tribune in 1948, there certainly was. Irish women at that stage were buying 1,200,000 hats a year.
The hat as a fashion accessory was universal. Hats were part of the essential item of an outfit, and part of a sort of respectability culture that in terms of attending church and family occasions such as communions and weddings.
Staff numbers grew quickly. There were 250 employed when Veronica Joyce arrived.
I worked there for must be about 6 years. I started about the age of 15. We had to wear the blue apron with our name on it. In our room, there was a big crowd of girls, and they did all the fancy work on the hats. When you were training, you'd sit at a table, and the girls would call you to get ribbon or feathers or whatever to trim the hats. And eventually, then you were allowed trim. You were shown how to do it. You'd have to get used to sitting on a stool without a back on it, and you had to get used to the noise in the factory. And it took a while to do that. Now, we worked from 8 till 1 and 2 until 5:30 and a half day Saturday. In all that noise, you had to be in at 8 o'clock, and there was a man called Timmy. And if you were 1 minute late, the door was closed on you. So you lost a half day.
A harsh policy. But Veronica says Tim Lally was a nice man who was only doing his job. An article written by Eileen O'Fuelon in 1941 for The Bell, a literary magazine, takes us into the factory and reveals what she calls the mysterious process of making a hat from start to finish.
The manager's shrug is expressive as he bows one forward to the great stockroom piled high with thousands of stacks of hoods, the rough shapes that come from the felt factory in Castlebar. For Castlebar is now the source of supply for felt. None is imported. Here too are the miles and miles of silk ribbons for the trimming room, all supplied by Longford.
O'Fuelon is referring here to two factories also financed by Jewish refugee businessmen from Austria and Czechoslovakia. The initial plan had been to relocate the entire enterprise in Galway, but it would appear that the need to spread opportunities for employment to other towns took priority. Let's continue with Eileen's colourful account of her visit.
The blocking room is an exciting place. You see boys and young men with the faces of sea rovers standing over the hats steaming on the moulds, pressing and coaxing into shape every possible type of hat, from the simplest sports hat to the most extravagant and over-glamorous film star hat, bretons, sombreros, gypsy shape. They all come to life under the strong yet delicate fingers of the Galway boys.
Wooden moulds were carved on site. This was a highly skilled craft which involved chiselling designs into shapes made from lime wood. Giovanni Bruzzi, an Italian native living in Paris, was invited to Galway in 1946 to do this work. Unlike the majority of the pre-war arrivals who at the end of the war returned home or emigrated elsewhere, Giovanni settled in Galway, continuing to carve moulds until the 60s, when wood was completely replaced by aluminium. She goes on to describe the journey of the hats through drying rooms, dampening rooms and dispatch rooms, and is particularly taken with the trimming room where Veronica and Margaret worked.
Here, immense tables are piled high with ribbons of every shade, feathers of every known and many unknown birds, spangles, buckles, threads, fancies, flowers, notions beyond number. A room to seduce the most staid matron in the world. Here, about 80 girls and women work from models under the supervision of the chief designer, Miss Schwenk.
When you'd have so much heads drawn, trimmed, and that she would take them up to the top bench. And she would examine them and then send them back to you again if they weren't dry, I tell you. You'd get 25 hats and you'd get a sample hat, and they'd have to follow the instruction of the sample hat. And then at the table in that room there was Kathleen May Boyle and Nancy Davran, and they would check the hats when they were finished. If there was anything wrong, they'd bring them back to you and you'd have to redo them.
As the women's pay was based on their output, they were under pressure to work quickly while ensuring that the hats passed inspection. As Eileen takes her leave, her thoughts sum up the immense pride there was in the enterprise.
As I left the factory, a little dazzled and stunned by it all, I realised that this was not a factory, but an industry, self-contained and unsubsidised. And I felt, what a good job they had made of it.
Clearly, the work was intense, with management striving to meet production targets. Despite this, it seems to have been a happy, sociable place, though there was a strike. More about that later. The majority of employees were female and from the city. A lot had several members of their family or extended family working alongside them. For women, it was a social outlet. The trimming room workers were able to chat as they sewed. Heather Gardner remembers her mother, May Lines, talking about the factory throughout her life, though she only worked there for a few years.
Ethel Murray, Maud Sweeney and May Lines were great friends. They used to go to Dublin for a day out together. She absolutely loved it.
As did Veronica.
We'd go back a bit early at lunchtime and we'd stay in the cloakroom. And I had a friend there called Bridie Duggan. She was from Grealishtown. Bridie and I'd be singing and she'd be teaching me how to dance, do the foxtrot and quickstep, until it was time to go into our room at 2 o'clock. They were lovely, lovely people to work with. They were typical Galway people.
Of course, they weren't all Galway people. There were those who had come here in 1937 from Germany and Austria to help set up the factory. Not all identified as Jewish, but as they were deemed to be so by the Nazis, they had lost their jobs and homes and came to Galway not by choice, much like migrants today fleeing war and harsh regimes. Unlike the present, however, the Irish government during World War II and the period leading up to it steadfastly rejected visa applications unless they came from skilled workers who could be of benefit to the state. It is estimated that as few as 200 and maybe only 140 were granted visas during this period. The previously mentioned Marcus Whitsum, a director of the Galway factory, is credited with arranging admissions for many of his fellow Jews. For those who came from Paris and Vienna to Galway, it must have seemed a strange place. In his memoir, Lost in Vienna, George Clare, a refugee himself, gives an indication of how Europeans might have felt about being exiled to the west coast of Ireland.
I am no longer living in Dublin, but in Galway, which had once been described to me as lying on the other side of the edge of the world. Seen from London, Paris is only on the other side of the Channel. But from Galway, it seems light years away.
Thea, a hat designer, wrote to her former boss.
I am doing well in business and my performance is satisfactory. But the sorrow is making me gloomy. And on top of this, I feel like a traitor to my family. I am sitting here home and dry and my people are overloaded with grief.
The war had a severe impact on the managers and directors who had been so excited by the new venture in 1937.
In 1939, Aubach and Goldberg were called into the French army, and of course after the fall of France, everything kind of fell apart. Aubach, Goldberg and Serge Philipson's wife and daughter were trapped in France. During that time, Aubach continued to send fashion advice. Philipson was desperately trying to keep the factory going. He had to work really hard to find new supplies. Then he had to develop new trade networks. He was also desperately trying to save his family.
Rachel Philipson Levy's memoir, An Odyssey Revisited, gives an account of how she and her extended family hid out in various parts of France.
Sadly, her mother Sophie, her grandmother and her uncle Henri Orbach were arrested in Nice in 1944. They were deported to Auschwitz, where they died. Given that the refugees were displaced from their homes and worried about the fate of family and friends, it is not surprising that there seems to have been very little social interaction with locals. Apart from events organised by management, in general it would seem they kept to themselves.
Michael John Gersey used to bring them in a pony and trap from their house and bring them to the factory.
The pony and trap was reserved for managers, including the head designer, Miss Schwenk.
If Miss Schwenk called you, you'd be shaking in your shoes. She was very, very strict.
She was serious enough, but she was nice.
In accordance with the original plan, the Irish were trained up in all aspects of production. Locals like Michael Hernan acquired skills in design. Opportunities for promotion were availed of by the likes of Cornelius O'Sullivan, more generally known as Corny O'Sullivan. He started aged 23 on the ground floor in 1939. By the mid-40s, he had replaced the well-regarded Wolf Zeiler as floor manager. He moved to Dublin, as did Serge Philipson, who continued to work in the company head office. Following Philipson's departure, J.P. McDermott became the general manager. By 1943, McDermott is the public face of the company when they have to deal with the strike which broke out on the 9th of July. The immediate cause was dismissal of one male employee, which resulted in 53 men downing tools. They were joined 2 days later by 62 women. The striker's position was outlined in the Connacht Tribune.
That worker's dismissal was brought about by a system which we feel should not be tolerated, as it is a direct reflection on the honesty and loyalty of all Irish workers, and particularly on the workers employed in the Galway hat factory.
The following week, management responded and insisted that nobody was dismissed, but that the employee left voluntarily after refusing to apologise for abusive language used to a fellow worker. However, the letter went on to state that a local man was promoted to a supervisory capacity carrying increased pay, and that that was the sole cause of the unofficial strike action. With only 44 workers going in, the factory ceased production. There were threats that the entire enterprise would relocate to Dublin. The strike, which was not sanctioned by the Irish Transport and General Workers Union, came to an end a month later on August 21st. All workers came back to work apart from 9 men who were not rehired. It's unclear as to how the dispute was resolved, as neither side made a statement. This was not the first problem that the company had encountered. In its first year, it was at the centre of a political row.
There was criticism of Fianna Fáil industrial policy from opposition politicians. Regarding the Jewish industries, including the Galway hat factory, it was sometimes expressed in anti-Semitic terms. James Dillon, a leading Fine Gael figure, referred to the incoming industrialists as exploiters and demanded that, quote, those people be sent back to the country from where they came. Peter Kelly, an opposition candidate in Galway in the 1938 election, specifically criticised Jews at meetings in Abinacmoy, Turlochmore and Galway. Kelly, though, was taken to task by local trade unionist Bartley Kane. There's enough of Jew baiting going on at present in Italy and Germany, Kane wrote. More power to the Jews for putting their money into these factories.
There was a crisis even before the factory opened when retailers threatened a boycott. The problem rested in their belief that consumer choice would be restricted as the Galway factory was getting preferential treatment and hats manufactured abroad would be no longer available. The matter was resolved before the grand opening in July. A report in the Irish Times indicates that some customers weren't that happy.
If Galway's to make all our hats, we cannot hope for any variety.
I'll go without a hat. or go where I can make my own choice.
Fears of missing out were assuaged with newspaper ads emphasising the connection with Parisian and Viennese fashion houses. The factory survived the controversies and the trade limitations brought about by the war. It didn't quite reach the original target to produce 1 million hats a year, nor did it realise an initial plan to employ up to 500 or 600. At its height, 250 worked there, and some of these would be laid off during quiet periods. This practice gave rise to a certain amount of tension and stress.
The trainees were let go in the summer because there was no sale for the hats. We had no money.
That used to upset us dreadfully. You know, we wouldn't know who Corny Sullivan would let on. You'd be waiting to be called back. You'd get worried if someone was called that had been working after you had got your job. Even though the salary was really low, our mothers depended on the few bob.
In fact, the wages were average for the 1940s. Union official Bartley Kane stated that very few factories had as good conditions or wages as Les Modes Modernes. Trainees started at £1.15. After 18 months, a man could take home £2.05. Income from piecework in the trimming room could vary.
The most I ever got in the 6 years was £3.10, but it used to be basically just over £2 a week.
That a woman could potentially earn more than a man was a source of concern for the church, which viewed this development as a threat to the social order. Another cause for concern was that the new factories were managed by foreigners who were not Catholic. The church often exerted its presence by having local bishops bless the facilities. Bishop Michael Brown did the honours in Galway on opening day. As was often the case with this rather cantankerous bishop, the event didn't meet with his full approval.
Bishop Michael Brown came to do the blessing. The machinery kept running and he was so cross and outraged that the machinery hadn't stopped. So he sent a letter and he kind of implied that he felt that because they were Jewish management that they hadn't given the respect he needed.
However, his lordship was conflicted, as he did want to see improvements in the local economy and urged women to support the industry by ditching their headscarves in favour of hats. Inside the church was represented by a statue of the Virgin Mary. This was on the altar in the trimming room. Women who worked there in the 60s report that the statue was still in situ. From their description, very little had changed. Tim Lally was still in charge of clocking in the workers after sounding the siren, which one woman describes as depressing, like what you'd hear in a war film. Socials were still being held in hotels like the Imperial or the Odeon. The women recalled conferring with Michael Hernan on design matters. At this point, there are far fewer permanent workers. University students are hired during the summer months. One reason for the drop in numbers is that people like Heather Gardner's mother, May Lines, is now working from home.
Early 1960s, they used to outsource the finishing of the hats, the trimming. I think it was every 2 weeks, a little van would arrive and this big wicker hamper with maybe 30 hats in it that need to be finished. They didn't actually want people at that stage to come in to do it.
Overall, the industry was in decline due to the reduction of tariffs, which gave rise to an increase in competition from abroad. The main cause, however, was the change in fashion, which was heavily influenced by film stars such as Grace Kelly and Marilyn Monroe. Their sporting of colourful headscarves was bad news for a Les Modes Modernes. The closure of the factory was announced in 1972, at which point only 30 people were employed. The initial reaction to the threatened closure by some employees was to keep the factory going. The Connacht Tribune reported that they were refusing to allow equipment to be removed from the building and were vowing to continue production as a cooperative. The company agreed to give them some equipment at a nominal charge. As promises of support from local businessmen did not materialise, it appears that the idea of a co-op was abandoned. The factory was sold at auction for £67,000 to the Guinness-owned Connacht Mineral Waters. There was one man, however, who was not willing to give up. Remember Cornelius O'Sullivan, also known as Corny? His daughter, Paula Scully, tells us of his valiant efforts to keep the trade that he loved going.
When the hat factory closed in 1972, Dad was arranging for, like, you know, things to be tidied up, cleaned up. They were trying to keep it going, but obviously financially and everything else, that wasn't feasible. Dad did buy the equipment from the factory. He bought what he needed. And from there, he set up in his own garage in the back of our house. So I do remember as a young child, Dad worked there in the garage for about a year. I remember looking into the garage, I'd look from the side door, and there was a big, long bench, tall bench, and on it were all the moulds, the aluminium head moulds. So Dad then would put on the mould and the steam was rising, and I remember him pulling down levers and then up again, and he'd be shaping it and steam again, and then, you know, yeah, putting it down and shaping it and turning it and levers going, and then there was hand pedals on the floor, and yeah, it was just steam, steam, steam. It'd be put to dry and then come back the next day and start all over again, a new batch, or continue on. Then he'd get what he had ready and deliver to the women for them to trim. Dad then would take them home, box them, label them, and he supplied one big supplier called Pauline's, which was in Henry Street in Limerick. I would actually remember, like, going to bed, whatever, 8 o'clock, and he'd be in the garage still. So basically 12 hours a day. Yeah. And for pittance, really, that's what he knew. That was his skill. He loved making hats, tried to keep it going, but hats were on the way out.
Well, hats off to Cornelius. If we recall the process outlined by Eileen O'Fuelan, his was a remarkable achievement indeed. As you've heard, the factory had its ups and downs, but it occupies an important place in Galway's and Ireland's industrial history. For many, it was their first encounter with industrial work. It shaped their lives and the lives of their families, and has left memories that will be passed on.
Now, Darren is having a look at sport with me for the weekend. Darren, morning to you. How are you today?
Good morning, Keith. How are you keeping?
Good. Thanks for joining us today. Now, soccer-wise, Derry City versus Galway United, Premier Division. It's a big test, Darren.
Yeah, big test against the Derry outfit on form, Keith. And of course, Galway United had last week off, but now they're back in action. And of course, one thing Galway United have not enjoyed, even in the first division, is double headers. We're home against Bohemians on Monday in AM&TC Park at 7:45. Tickets should be on sale now, in general sale, for that game. And of course, tonight's game, our live match in Over the Line, Derry City, second in the table at the moment. They did lose to Bohemians the last day out. Galway United just struggling to score goals, have suffered a couple of 1-0 defeats, and you're on 7 points. But they're still in fifth. A good start to the season, Keith, it has to be said. And hopefully we can come back from the Brandywell with even a point on the board tonight. However, one person we have to watch out for is actually a Galway man too, and it's Loughrea's Pat Hoopen. He was a Dundalk player last year, signed for Derry City, has already scored 6 goals this season, 2 more than Galway United have managed in their games so far. And I was talking to John Caulfield during the weekend. We just talked about the threat of the Derry strike force, including Pat Hoopen.
They have a front line there of Michael Duffy, who has several leagues with Dundalk, Patrick Hoban, who has, you know, been prolific in our league for many years when he played, as he's played here, Daniel Kelly again on the wing for who came from Bohemians. So they have pace and power, and look at Darren, the bottom line is they paid big to Patrick Hoban from Dundalk. They paid a transfer fee, you know, I believe he's the second highest earner in the league, and they paid for one reason, to win the league. And you know, and already he's delivered for them, so we know how good he is, and it's going to be a massive test to our centre backs. But at the same time, You know, we did come up against them last year for Dundalk in the cup game in Terryland, and our centre backs that day, Rob Sliven and Killian Bruder, did very well. So let's hope they can do the same again on Friday night.
We certainly hope so. That was John Caulfield, the Galway United manager. 7:45 live tonight from the Ryan McBride Brandywell, Derry City versus Galway United. Keith, just a few other games I want to mention. The Galway United women's team, they're back in Sligo tomorrow in the Premier Division. They won 2-0 in the All-Ireland Cup last week. We'll hear from their manager Phil Trill tonight on Over the Line as well. He's a couple of interesting thoughts about women's soccer, but that's a game we'll be keeping an eye on. And then on Sunday in AM&TC Park at 2 o'clock, the girls under 19 Interleague Cup gets underway for Galway. They host North Tipperary.
Now let's look at rugby, because Benetton versus Connacht, it's a United Rugby Championship on Saturday at 1 o'clock. Now Connacht didn't really have a great time last week against the Lions. Can they afford to play like that again?
No, that's a very polite way of putting it, Keith, but we did talk about that Monday, right? No, looks, and they can't, to answer your question very, very simply. We're looking for the Connacht backlash. We'll have the team just before lunchtime today. Indeed, it might be announced over the next 10 minutes or so, but they're going to Benetton, an Irish team in Italy. They need to bounce back with something, definitely a performance, Keith, at least. Benetton are Italy's top franchise, are very, very difficult to beat at home. And look, we're looking forward to the game that's live at 1 o'clock here in Galway BFM tomorrow, but no, that performance against the Lions last week, that doesn't work. Hopefully Connacht can bounce back tomorrow and get themselves back in top 8 contention in the United Rugby Championship.
Now Camogie, Galway versus Cork, it's again the National League, it's in Duggan Park at 2 o'clock.
Yeah, League Champions versus All-Ireland Champions, Keith. One of them could be out of the league come tomorrow because they're both joint top with Tipperary in Division 1A. Tipperary are playing Clare, who are bottom of the table. You would expect that they'll be good enough to make a league final spot. Look, Galway and Cork, we had a good record against them, but then Cork beat us in last year's All-Ireland semi-final on their way to All-Ireland glory. So it's definitely a sporting fixture of the weekend. I'm really looking forward to in Duggan Park, Ballinasloe tomorrow. When these two come together, they rarely disappoint, and we'll have Tommy Devan and Imelda Hobbins with live commentary on that game at 2 o'clock tomorrow. Just before we move on, Keith, I wanted to mention with ladies football, Galway under 14s begin their Connacht campaign tomorrow. Festival of Football up in the Connacht GA Centre in Bacon. They play two games against Leitrim at 11 a.m. and Sligo at 12 p.m. while the Galway under 16s, they travel to Roscommon, that game in St. Croan's, also tomorrow at 1 o'clock.
Now, football, the club leagues are up and running in some big games in Division 1 of the football this weekend.
Yeah, indeed. We'll have updates tonight with PJ Lynch on Clare Galway versus Cora Finn in Division 1. Both teams winning the opening day out. And look, I like about the club leagues is, even though they don't have their inter-county players, it gives an opportunity for club players to get involved. If there's one good thing coming from the split season, still a lot of tweaking to be done. I know that it's given club players games. And these leagues worked well last year. Your divisions of 8, the top 4 go into semi-finals after 7 games. The bottom 4 go into relegation. As I mentioned, Clare Galway versus Cora Finn, that's on at 7:30 this evening. And 3 big games tomorrow if you're out and about. Killannon host Tuam Star, St. Michael's host Barna, Mount Ballymaloch host Milltown. All those games thrown in at 5 o'clock. And also, Keith, to give a mention to the Galway under-20s. Disappointing loss against Mayo on Wednesday night. They are home in Tuam Stadium next Wednesday at 6:15. The clocks are going forward. The light is back. Galway host Sligo, who are the defending champions.
Now, basketball, Mary, have a fairly busy weekend. 7 o'clock, Calasanta's College, and they're on a roll.
They're on a roll again, Keith. Of course, we remember the wonderful season they had last year. Well, they host DBS in the semi-final of the Men's Super League. It was the one competition they didn't win last year, so hopefully they can pick up that silverware this year. Calasanta's College, or more, 7 o'clock. I think the game is sold out, but we have online coverage on goibfm.ie with John Mulligan and Adrian O'Neill from 7 o'clock, and it promises to be a cracker there as well. Hopefully Charlie Crowley's side can get the job done. We'll hear from their captain Owen Rockall later on. Want to give a quick mention to Titans there in an under 20 National Cup semi-final, also against Aina. They're away. That takes place on Monday at 1:30. So hopefully a Galway double, Keith.
Good stuff. Athletics?
Yeah, just one player or person I want to mention, Fiona Everett. She's from Cork, but she goes to University of Galway, but she's one of Ireland's brightest prospects, especially in cross country. She competes in the World Cross Country Championships in Serbia tomorrow, and we'll be keeping an eye on her. At about 10:45 a.m. in the morning, the senior women's 10,000 metre race. It's live on Virgin Media too, I do believe, around that time. You can hear a full interview with Fiona on her website, goibfm.ie, but best of luck to her.
And Over the Line tonight?
Over the Line, not to go through, Keith, but Derry City versus Galway United is our feature game. We will also have a preview of Connacht against Benetton. We'll have the Galway Camogie team to take on Cork, as I touched on already. We'll also hear from Phil Trill, the Galway United women's manager, and there'll be basketball and our usual racing roundup.
All right, that's tonight's a busy night, so it is, but thank you, Darren, for that.
Cheers, Kate.
Now, looking to Tuesday's programme when we're back with you again, and don't forget the Best Of goes out each and every morning this weekend, Saturday morning between 7 and 8 and Sunday morning between 7 and 8. And Tuesday morning, though, another busy show. We'll be talking to Cathy Connolly from Galway Rape Crisis Centre about an exciting fundraiser they'll be launching soon. We'll also hear from Maria Walsh about the upcoming Clifton Tradfest there. Lucy O'Callaghan will be on to talk about her new novel, The Lies Beneath. The Guard of the Slot, please God, they'll have a quiet weekend. We'll have trending topics with our colleague, and Helen from Evergreen will be here to take your health-related questions and much more on Tuesday morning's programme. So in the meantime, have a good weekend. The Mike Denver ticket winner is Anne-Marie Salmon in Ballinasloe. We'll be doing that again on Tuesday morning here on the programme as well. But thank you indeed to the crew from Mike Denver's for that. But Anne-Marie Salmon, Ballinasloe, congratulations to you. That is it for today. That is it for this weekend. We're back with you on Tuesday morning, so we are. We have 9 programmes left until I go into retirement from radio. So do join us next Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and all of the following week as well. Thank you to Leah, who produced all week this weekend. We hope that she has a restful weekend because she's been working awful hard. God love her. Thank you to Fiona for taking all of the comments as well today. But from yours, really, Keith Finnegan, have a really nice, holy, simple, whatever way you want to do Easter yourself, and take it nice and handy. From all of us to you, a sincere happy Easter. Enjoy the rest of your weekend, and we'll talk to you Tuesday morning just after the 9 o'clock news. A very good morning to you.